Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined by probably one of my best emergency medicine friends, one of, for those that are getting jealous out there, one of my best podcasting friends and hands down my favorite Canadian, and Dr. Ken Milne. He's been on the show several times, and you know, I turn to Ken Milne for about everything related to research. It's one of those things that I readily admit that I am not a researcher, a breaker downer of research, or any of those things, shape, form, or fashion. And so Ken can testify that whenever I have a question about research, especially if it's going to be multiple studies associated with it, I text Ken. And so he's back here on the podcast once again because he's had, with his podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, some really interesting transformations earlier in just recently. And then especially with COVID, he's been dealing a lot with the quality or paucity or whatnot of research. But there's also some changes in research of one of the things that we all tend to use and gets pushed on many of us, and that is TPA. So we wanted to talk about that just a little bit. So Dr. Milne, thanks for joining us here on the Frontline Podcast. How things been up there in the great North?
Oh, it's been good. We've done relatively well compared to our southern neighbors when it comes to COVID. Crossing our fingers and physically distancing. And I would like to emphasize one of my pet peeves is hearing everybody talk about socially distancing. We don't need to social distance, okay? You heard that here from me. You and I, we're Zooming here. We're not socially distancing. We're hanging out. We're having a drink. We're catching up. We're socially connected. What we need to do is physically distance. We need to stay that 6 feet, and I'll translate that to all the Canadian listeners, to 2 meters apart, right? So let's try to physically distance people, but let's keep up our social connections. We need them more than ever now in COVID times.
And that may be why Canada's had such success with COVID, is your 2 meters being slightly more than our 6 feet, by just a hair. It's that extra number of inches is really what we needed. And we should have gone, I mean, this is another testimony for why some areas of the northern states have it correct with going to kilometers and meters rather than miles, feet, and inches.
Or it could be, and this is just a layperson's observation, in Florida, when a Canadian goes to Florida and they tell us, okay, time to get out of the pool, all the Canadians go, oh, sorry, yeah, we'll get out now. Is there anything I could do to help you? Whereas if you tell the Americans to get out of the pool, they give you a different response.
From the apartment, from the raucous apartment downstairs, we appreciate that you came on the show today. And what we're going to talk about is, and if you actually listen to our last podcast was from ASAP 19, where we brought an early season snowfall just to help Ken feel at home to Denver, Colorado. And it seemed like forever ago. It was like an entire pandemic ago that we were together and we had our comparisons of our Kentucky bourbons and our Canadian maple whiskey, which actually I referenced this weekend as somebody who mentioned that Canadian whiskey was incredible. And I said, I do know that from my friend, Dr. Milne, up in Canada. And we did fantastic. And so we come together again because we're always interacting, talking about some of the communications and education and quality of research and depth of research. And we have actually had conversations before, not on the podcast, you know, formally, but concerning the level of evidence and the recent changes that have come with TPA with regard to stroke intervention. So give us an idea of where we are now and what has changed most recently.
Well, the most recent change is that a reanalysis of ECAS-3 came out, and that was by Brian Alper, and he published that in Evidence-Based Medicine Journal, and that's a subsection journal of the BMJ. And what Brian did was he took ECAS-3, which is the only randomized control trial in the world's literature that shows, or sorry, I should say, claims efficacy of TPA between 3 and 4.5 hours. And if I remember correctly, it was about a 6 to 7% absolute benefit. Now, for that benefit, there was a 9% absolute increase in bleeding, but only 2% of that was symptomatic bleeding, and there was no statistical difference in mortality. So what he did was he took that data set, that same data set, and said, well, what happens if you can control for the imbalances due to the randomization process? Sometimes you just get imbalances. And what they found was that after randomization, the placebo group were slightly sicker. They had slightly worse stroke scores. And Ryan, you know, one of the biggest, strongest predictors of how somebody will do with a stroke in the long term is how bad the stroke was. And so if the placebo group was a little bit worse and the treatment group was a little bit better at baseline, you can see how that might affect the outcome. So what he did was he did some adjustments for those baseline differences. And when he ran the data again, the same data set, just using that analysis to control for baseline differences, the efficacy went away. The harm stayed. You still had bleeds, but the claimed efficacy went away. Now, this is very similar to the reanalysis of the NINS trial, which is the only other study in the world's literature of a lytic that claimed benefit. And that was reanalyzed by the legend of emergency medicine, Jerry Hoffman, back in 2009. And they did the same thing and found the same thing, that when they reanalyzed and controlled for baseline differences, the efficacy went away. And so now, with that final reanalysis by Brian Alper, of the 13 studies that have been done on lytics, the randomized control trials that have been done on lytics, zero, oh yes, a nice round number, zero lytic studies show efficacy if you take those two reanalyses into consideration. And then you go to shake your head. Okay, you've got 13 studies. None of them can demonstrate a statistical benefit. Four of them were stopped early due to increased harm or futility. You gotta think, what are we doing? And that's what Brian Alper challenged us in his paper that he just published, and said we should reconsider this treatment modality for acute ischemic stroke. And I agree with him. We should reconsider it.
The question being, though, it seems like in medicine, and I've always said that it's easier to never do something than it is to undo something. It seems like now we are 12 hours into our road trip and thinking about going back and getting the tickets to the theme park that we forgot sitting at the house. And, you know, first and foremost, glad you mentioned Jerry Hoffman, because if you want to know when we record this, today we released a podcast with Jerry Hoffman, talking about some of the social determinants of health that we actually recorded at ASEP 19. I love talking to Jerry Hoffman. Gave me a great book that I'm actually reading right now. So if you haven't checked out the podcast with Dr. Milne, as well as our Frontline podcast with Jerry, you will never be disappointed. And what do you call him on your program? He is one of the dun-dun-dun
legends of emergency medicine.
See, and that's how this works. And so now we've got, you mentioned 13 studies for a medication or a therapy that is getting pushed almost incessantly in healthcare, but especially in U.S. healthcare. How do we go from something that was going to be considered the potential miracle treatment for strokes to now saying we need to relook at where we are at all, because we don't have any of these studies that shows that it is on the positive end of benefit?
So I'll answer your question with a question. Are we not scientists? Didn't we not co-opt the white lab coat after the Flexner report came out in 1910? Didn't we wrap ourselves up in the veil of science to say, we are scientists, we want legitimacy, we want credibility, we want to separate ourselves from the snake oil salesman? We are physicians, and we are going to let the evidence guide our care. And science, as you know, is iterative. It changes, usually in little baby steps, but sometimes there's big leaps, but usually it's iterative. But it's also self-correcting. And so when new information comes in, a good scientific skeptic or a good physician will take that new information, think about it, consider it, and think about how you could apply it to the patient in front of you, because it starts with patient care and it ends with patient's care. And don't we want patients to get the best care based on the best evidence?
Absolutely. And it just almost falling into the argument of that we see with two or not two with epinephrine for resuscitations or cardiac arrest. You know, the question is, will this, I think one of the biggest challenges we will face in reevaluation of this research is that I feel like in medicine, more often than not, we feel like we have to have something. And just like the public who feels like they need to walk out of the emergency department with a prescription, I think in medicine, falling back to we don't have necessarily anything else is not an acceptable answer to how are we going to manage this significant acute condition that presents to the emergency department.
And what you're describing is something called intervention bias. And there is an intervention bias in medicine. It feels better that we're doing something, right? Psychologically, it feels like we're doing something. But there's a great paper, and it quotes Jerry Hoffman, don't just do something, stand there. And there is an art to doing that. There is, by standing there and not doing something, you actually are doing something. And by doing something, sometimes can cause more harm. And I'm not saying, you know, TPA doesn't work. That would be a shifting of the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on those claiming that it does work. And evaluating 13 trials on lytics, because not all of them were on TPA, some used other lytic agents, but evaluating the literature on lytics, it's clear, to me at least, that I'm not convinced that it does work. It doesn't mean that there isn't a subsection of population, that we got advanced imaging, if you got weight diffused MRI scans or perfusion scans, sorry, with CTs, that you could find a niche that it could have a net patient-oriented outcome. I just don't know who those people are.
And we've seen that with the mechanical thrombectomies or the procedural aspects where they came out and then it started to pull back to the point that it was almost dead in the water of saying in the global stroke population, it is not beneficial and the harm is going to outweigh that potential benefit.
So should we stop? Should we not change then? No, science moves forward.
And then they found the niche and they had the studies that found the large vessel occlusions, especially the M1 branch of the middle cerebral artery, that if it's done there, it is beneficial and it is in an integral aspect of the stroke service now, showing that evolution of science. And as we talk about things with COVID and communicating with the public, I'm always happy understanding, but frustrated that the public doesn't understand that physicians and medicine in general, science in general, are some of the biggest skeptics out there. It's tell me, show me, and then prove it. And then I'm still not necessarily convinced. I'm willing to come back down the road and even question that further.
It's always an open question to some degree. And science doesn't give us the truth. There is no quote unquote truth. Science doesn't make truth claims. It attempts in a methodology to give us the best point estimate of an observed effect. So what's the best point estimate of the observed effect? And that can change depending on what kind of experiment you set up. And we've got to look at the literature, but the literature only informs our care, it guides our care. And one of the biggest problems that I have with the stroke literature is that it was very weak, but it was translated into thou shalt. And you know, I'm not saying not give TPA. I don't want people to come away from this to say, Dr. Milne says, don't give TPA. TPA doesn't work. That is not my position. My position is, I'm not sure if it does work. I'm not sure if it has a net patient-oriented benefit. I'm unclear which patient it will work on if it does work. And it's okay to be unsure. It's okay not to know. And you and I deal with uncertainty in emergency medicine all the time. Every shift we'll have limited information, weak data informing our care, thin slicing, and yet we still make decisions. And so the literature informs our care, but we still have a patient in front of us and we need to use our clinical judgment when talking to that patient. And we also have to ask them, what are their values and preferences? Because, you know, people have asked me, what would you do if you had a stroke? And my response is, if it was a mild stroke, I don't want TPA. There's things that I want to do and things that I can still do. And I know rehab works really well. But if I have a catastrophic stroke, there are worse things than a modified Rankin score of 6, death. The worst is a modified Rankin scale score of 5, in my opinion. I do not want to be physically and severely disabled, not able to enjoy life. And so, lice me.
Exactly. And I'd say the same thing to our stroke navigators is, you know, I'm going to really dig down to see if I can figure out, you know, the person I think is a legitimate stroke who's going to most benefit, you know, based on the available evidence that's presented to us at that point. But, you know, if I come in with an NIH of 20, swing away, because it's not worth to me living it's not even considered a life at that point.
You know,
and that's your personal preference. Exactly. And value. And I wouldn't put that on somebody else. And so the only way we know what a patient's values and preferences are, ask them.
Shared decision-making.
Exactly. And so that's where, you know, this could be a potential opportunity. And that's why I get pulled back from how we've reorganized our whole stroke system into being this time-dependent, go, go, go. And if we're paying lots of attention and we're calling code strokes, what are we not paying attention to and how much difference will it make? It takes place in a context. It doesn't take place in isolation. And, you know, the old saying, if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? And if that's the only treatment, I guess we've got EVT now, but it's thrombolyze, thrombolyze, thrombolyze when it's maybe not everybody.
And why we so much in as emergency medicines in our CT scanners are pushing to get the accurate information, get that risk stratification, because we always know that everybody in stroke situations are in a hurry, missing data, missing information, unclear stories, onset.
You know, the universal.
And you're going to be evaluated on this with metrics.
Yes.
Metrics. Really? Based on 2 studies that out of 13 that have claimed benefit that now have both been reanalyzed and the benefit is no longer demonstrated, and you're going to have a metric and you're going to have an administrator come down on you to say, well, how come that person was 5 minutes this way or that way?
And it is down to minutes, and it's getting pushed higher and higher. Now, you mentioned a couple of things, and you talk about these on frequency when we're educating and teaching, that being 1, burden of proof, and 2, being a patient-centered outcome. Kind of explain those and why those are such a key aspect of evidence with regard to the practice of medicine.
So if you think scientifically, the burden of proof means that those making the claim have the burden. And it's not called easy, it's called a burden, because it's hard. It's hard to demonstrate something typically has superiority, because that's usually what we're testing. And they have the burden of proof. And then we have a null hypothesis. And the null hypothesis is there is no superiority. And that's the default position. So the burden of proof is on those making the claim. If you claim that a lytic provides a POO, a patient-oriented outcome, demonstrate it. Show me the evidence. You know, who was it? Hitchens, who said something like, things that can be claimed without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. You can say, nah, I don't believe you. Show me the evidence. Convince me. And if you convince me, I will accept your claim. If you don't convince me, and we'll all have different levels of acceptance of what we will take to accept a claim, then the default position is to accept the null hypothesis that there is no superiority. And that's how science usually works.
And the problem we're seeing right now with COVID is everybody's trying to jump towards that solution as opposed to reaching that burden of proof and evidence in order to get there. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, but you had more you were about to say.
No, that's okay, because that made me think of the wonderful Simon Carley and his group out of St. Emlyn's, who just published a fantastic paper.
Who you just had on your podcast.
Yeah, how evidence-based medicine is just so much more important now with regards to the literature, the level, raising the bar, right? Raising the bar, not lowering the bar, but while still using our good clinical judgment. Because, you know, a lot of things that have come out of COVID, anecdotes and things like that, are hypothesis generating. Jump on those, look into those, and do the proper experiments or research before you go, okay, everybody's going to get this. And now we're going to make this into a standard protocol. And we're not, you know, we're going to do an observational study. And by the way, this will be a performance standard and you'll be quality assessed on this. And you're like, what? Based on an anecdote? No, an anecdote triggers a hypothesis. You test the hypothesis in controlled situations. And if it works, you accept it. And if it doesn't, you don't accept it. Your hypothesis was wrong. Done.
And one of the most important things that you've always talked about when we've chatted is the importance of having that comparison to control. And so many studies out there, you know, will look at a treatment or an intervention, but without a placebo or control arm to compare to just see how the normal population or the normal evolution of the disease process or actually the improvement that you may see by thinking you got an intervention.
The natural history of disease or, you know, recall bias. We remember our hits, we forget our misses. Oh, all the patients who survived did really well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just don't count the ones who died.
Well, that's always the people who died never come back to tell the story about how that didn't work. So, right? That's a good old pirate translation to the modern era of medicine. And, you know, I think a lot of us forget about that, especially looking at, you know, the trends that we're seeing now with the statement and proclamations of research and data. Of course, you know, one of the biggest ones out there, and we're straying a little bit off of TPA and stroke related care, is, you know, we have that this with we'll just use the hydrochloroquine study, you know, the retrospective observational case review study versus the actual controlled trials that are out there. And of course, the everything is, we already have a cure out there. Why aren't doctors using that thing? And understanding that level of research with how much does it actually reach that burden of proof versus the purpose of this type of study being the hypothesis generator to do more research. But what we're seeing now is with the opening of research, the opening of the evidence, you used to have to go to a medical library and find the data, or it came to your house. The public didn't have access to it. The rest of medicine didn't necessarily have access to the emergency medicine data unless they went to the medical library and checked out that particular journal or whatever it may be. How has that challenged us into understanding the tiers necessary to get to the point of initiating a treatment and the quality of evidence, and especially when we're dealing with a pandemic, when the evidence is playing out in the media and social media?
Yeah, we have to be better science communicators. I think that's really important to be as transparent as possible. I'm a big advocate for transparency in research. And I think of it sort of like going to a wonderful Broadway production. You're sitting out in the audience as the general public and you see this show put on, this scientific publication that came out that's so, you know, it's got the abstract and the method section and the results section and the discussion section. It all looks so organized. But what's happened with COVID-19 is we've pulled the curtain back to backstage and you see all the little things going on and people running around and is this going to work and is that going to work and we're going to have to MacGyver this to tape this up and, you know, and we're showing how science works. It's messy. It can be a bit confusing. People can disagree. Caring, smart people can disagree. And that's okay. That's how science works. But the public, I think, is seeing it for the first time. So we've got to be better at communicating the process. And the other thing we have to be better at doing is saying, when do you accept a claim? When do you reach that burden? What's the tipping point for you going, yeah, I'm going to apply that in my clinical practice. And that'll be a bit different. In other words, I'm going to pull out my favorite expression. It all depends, right? And so there's the Carl Sagan famous line about, you know, I've got a fire-breathing dragon in my garage. Do you believe me, Ryan?
I would not shock me at any given time.
Because I assumed that you would need a little bit more evidence, maybe some video, a picture, some bones, some biological stuff. And also thinking Bayesian, the pretest probability is how many dragons have you seen in real life? How many dragons do you know that exist? And so that bar is a lot higher than if I said, hey, Ryan, you probably heard the sad news. Our dog passed away recently, but we got a new puppy and it's in the garage. Would you believe me then? Much more likely to believe me that I bought a new puppy and that it's in the garage because A, we know puppies exist. You've probably had experience with puppies over your lifetime. And so what level of evidence do we need? And so if somebody comes out and says, hydroxychloroquine can cure COVID, that's interesting. It's an anti-malarial drug primarily, but maybe it has some in vitro properties that, okay, from a pathophysiological, let's test it. And if it works in a high quality randomized control trial, you've got me. But if you're going to tell me we've got this observational retrospective study where all the patients had mild disease and they all did well, I thought mild disease usually does well. I'm not convinced.
And you actually, well, I agree. And you actually made another point that I don't know if you realized, but when you said Dr. Milne has a dragon in his garage, I'm more likely to believe it from you because you are a believable person. And that is what we're seeing. And you actually see that with the research is Yale researcher.
That's an argument from authority. I'm skeptical of anything.
Well, and that's right. And that's what you should do.
You know, high impact journals recently have had some retractions or had to walk things back. And so just because something's published in a high impact journal doesn't make it true. It also doesn't make it false. And just because you are published in a pre-publication, non-peer-reviewed, online service doesn't make the information correct or incorrect or true or false. Mm-hmm. What matters is it? And how do we determine that? By developing really good critical appraisal skills and a skeptical radar that goes, oh, that was an observational study and they claimed causation. Woot, 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 radar goes off. I don't think you can claim causation when there was only an association because it was an observational study.
Yeah, and the correlation causation aspect of things, but that is one of the challenges we face as scientists especially when dealing with a pandemic. Speaking of puppies in the background, mine is she is not very excited right now. She was our rescue, our COVID rescue.
I'm very excited because I get to talk to you. I'd rather be on the front lines than be on the sidelines.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And now I've got a hound mix down there getting all upset about things. But the idea of using that label, and we see it even within medicine, is it's Nijim or it's JAMA, so it has to be true. But when we play out to the public aspect of things is they're going to see Yale or they're going to see Nijim and JAMA and all those other things, and they're going to say it has to be true. And so we have to be even more careful and more intentional with our communication as scientists in medicine to say, pump the brakes. This is very interesting, but we need to dig deeper. And with regard to hydroxychloroquine, it's that pyramid that we shared that shows here's where that study is. Here's what else is there, and this is what the rest of it says.
Yeah, and I think with science communication, it's really good not to overinterpret and overstate your literature. And we're seeing that with press releases are coming out prior to the publication. You know, I don't practice medicine by press release. I practice medicine by the highest quality evidence that I can find so that my patients can get the best care based on the best evidence. It's not based on the best press release. But there is an emotional component to all of this. There's this time pressure, and this will be a segue back to the TPA and stroke literature. It's like, well, time is brain. It's a catastrophic illness. What are you going to do? That intervention bias, go, go, go. Time's a wasting. We make life and death decisions all the time Ryan, in the emergency department. We do that with, again, limited information, thin slicing, maybe incorrect information, but we make decisions all the time with time pressure. So we're good at this. And that's why I think, you know, when you look at the lytic literature, you have this dichotomization of specialties. And I think that's unfortunate. You have the emergency medicine community, which is very skeptical, I think. And I put up a Twitter poll about the reanalysis of ECAS-3 and said, should we reconsider lytic therapy for acute ischemic stroke? It was like 98% said yes. I never do a Twitter poll where I see an overwhelming supermajority. And yet neurologists, I'm sure if I gave them the same Twitter poll, because of course we have this following, and I try not to get into an echo chamber. I try to reach out beyond my usual. And yet I bet that they would have 98% the other way. And I'd like to bridge that divide and say, listen, we have common ground. We both want what's best for patient care. So let's get together, think rationally if we can, because there's emotions on both sides. I have biases. Everyone has biases. And let's get together and figure this out. And I think that's the main message that I want from this whole lytic discussion is, let's just sit down and reconsider.
Yeah, we do need to take a step back and take a look at everything. The challenge I see coming up is one, that lack of having a replacement other than a mechanical thrombectomy, which we know is that very narrow window of benefit, clearly. But also, I think it's such a huge machine at this point. And I think as medicine, we have to be willing to say, you know what, we have to do this. If not, it's going to end up as ads.
This is the 21st century. I mean, you know, the age of social media, knowledge translation, we should be cutting that knowledge translation window down faster. And you and I are getting a little bit of gray hair, maybe thinning hair, you know, to the point in our careers where there's a temptation to say, well, that's how we've always done it. We should avoid that at all costs. Because I am learning every day. I learned from you. I learned from other podcasters. I learned from the journals. I'm learning from patients every shift. I don't want to get into the rut and say, well, you know what? We always gave steroids for spinal cord injuries. Why should we change? Because the evidence didn't support it. And if the evidence doesn't support it, we shouldn't hold positions so dear to us that we can't change.
And I think one of the main bring home is that whole aspect is that we feel like we have to do something. And when you come up to somebody that has, you know, had an incident outside the hospital or whatnot, and everybody's trying to do something, they feel like they have to do something every given moment. We need to put a stick here and bandage this and put a belt around their foot, and we need to check a blood pressure and blood sugar and all kinds of stuff. And you're like, just wait, pump the brakes. What can you actually do with that data? And what is the potential risk to me, to them, to whatever of doing this intervention? And with stroke, you know, I think we're clear that this ever expanding window probably hasn't surpassed that burden of proof, and likely or potentially increases harm for the very low NIH and the extended amount of time out from last known well. And I think it is time as medicine that we take a look at it, sit back and say, where are we with this? And what are we going to do? And not fall back on the whole explanation of, well, there's nothing else to do, so we might as well do that. Which the first line or the first little segment of the Hippocratic Oath is, do no harm. And are we doing something potentially that could be increasing harm to our patients? And how do we find that point where we make that risk-benefit ratio a positive for the patient versus a positive for a metric or a banner on the outside of the hospital? And I think that's where we are right now with stroke care and stroke intervention is, are we adding value to the patients or taking it away? And as Dr. Milne mentioned, I think one of the key aspects to this moving forward is that shared decision-making, working with the patients and with the families, most importantly, because many times the patient can't communicate that. and working with them on where they want to be and what they want to do and the risks and the benefits and making that decision together. And that may mean adding another 3 or 5 or 10 minutes. And somebody's going to tell you, well, that's 8 or 10 million brain cells.
You know, that's the physiologic response. You know, like, does that make a clinical difference? How many brain cells do we have? And does the loss of that many brain cells make a difference? And by giving TPA, do you reestablish blood flow? And does the reestablishment of blood flow lead to a better neurologic outcome? Oh, that's right. We don't have any studies that show that on the granularity of tests, the modified Rankin score, the Oxford Handicap Scale, those types of things that we can do with the reanalysis of the lytic trials. And because we're on an ASEP podcast, I think we should identify that ASEP does have a policy on this. And the ASEP policy for that 3 to 4.5 hour time frame was based on ECAS-3, which claimed a benefit. So let's remind people, what did that say? It gives a level B recommendation, not a level A recommendation, a level B recommendation that says IV TPA may be offered. What does that mean, Ryan, if I say may be offered?
It may not be offered.
And may be given in carefully selected patients. What does that mean?
That means that we have to do shared decision-making and look at the particular situation.
Exactly. And so, and then they give a level C recommendation that says when feasible, shared decision-making between the patient and a member of the healthcare team should include discussions on the potential benefits and the potential harms in the decision of whether to administer that. And so I think we're still acting within those guidelines that guide our care. We should maybe offered and maybe given to carefully selected patients. And that's what we're talking about, carefully selecting. And now we have new information. So how do we absorb that new information? Well, we should think about it, reflect on it, talk to our colleagues about it. Don't do it in isolation. Talk to our neurology colleagues, again, who have common ground, who want the best for patient care. I start with common ground and then move forward. And that's what I'm trying to promote, is that let's move forward with this and say, where do we go from here? What do we do with this new information? Do we just dismiss it? Do we say, uh-uh? Or do we go, okay, that's interesting. What do we do now?
And neither Dr. Milne or I are saying that, you know, this may not be a potential benefit in a group of patients. What we are saying is that the evidence now needs a reevaluation, that we need to look at it and figure out where we can find benefit, where
we can benefit
and
our
maybe
patients.
Maybe with the new imaging technology that we have, because remember, NINS was done in what, 25 years ago, 1995. Were you practicing medicine then?
That was the 4-slice scanner. That may have been before that. That may have been the 1-slice, but that's probably 4-slice.
Waved over top.
Yeah, that was like the legitimate one where a head CT scan took 15 minutes.
Yeah, so I had just finished medical school in 1995 and started residency when NINS was published. We have these new advanced CT scanners and MRs that maybe there is a population with a perfusion mismatch, a penumbrum that can be salvageable that doesn't fit EVO, right? So if you've got something that you can go and mechanically open up, right? We have good evidence for that narrow group of people, that small cohort with that specific type of injury. But how about the rest that don't qualify? That's a bigger population. I'd like to know, okay, well, maybe they have a small mismatch. Maybe there's, you know, something on the perfusion scan that we can pick out and say, aha, they're going to be the ones that are benefiting. And the rest of them, all we're offering them is potential harm.
And I think the question now is, has our technology caught up to the actual treatment to say, yes, there may be. Now that we can look, do we need a time window at this point? Or can we look at the perfusion and say, this is what the brain is telling us?
And that's I think that's a really key point. And the person who actually coined the term time as brain has sort of modified their position. I won't say walked it back, but what's more, of course, time happens. But what's more important is, do you have salvageable brain? That's what's, and that could be 30 minutes after last seen well, or that could be a wake up. 9 hours, 12 hours, as long as the scan shows that there's something to salvage, there's something to salvage. And it's not actually, okay, let's start our watch. And then, oh, sorry, you're at 3 hours and 5 minutes, or you're at 4 hours and 35 minutes, and, you know, the window is closed. If we can get a perfusion, something that actually would help guide this care, I think would be really important and a very interesting study to conduct.
I agree. And I think that's got, I do have a lot of interest moving forward now that we have the technology to see that ischemic penumbra and the core infarct, which is the key to the interventional-based stroke stroke techniques with mechanical thrombectomy, whatever other what else may be there. That's kind of that key, is whether that will translate with good solid research into the medication-based interventions.
And so it makes you wonder, if you go back to, you know, these, like I said, there's 13 lytic trials, these big randomized control trials, these 13 lytic trials, and none of them now have been shown to demonstrate benefit with those two reanalyses. So that's the little asterisk on that. But some of them, right, the two that did show benefit and the other ones that didn't, I wonder if you could pull out the mismatches, those would work. And that's, they just couldn't get the granularity in there to select the correct patient population to provide it to. And so the rest of the population that didn't benefit washed out any positive effects that could have been picked up.
And I've never even thought about the idea that, you know, the stroke treatment has evolved through the entire evolution of the CAT scan era. That, you know, going from things where they were basically just used for gross changes to now we're doing complete stroke evaluations with CTA, head and neck, and perfusions in 4 or 5 minutes max.
And there's some obviously software involved that can help you like tease out those patients and stuff like that, from a 4-slicer to a 16-slicer to a 64 to a 128, to eventually they'll be able to go, oh, there's one blood vessel on this screen, or one corpuscle on this one, and then on the next slice we have the next corpuscle. I mean, it's going to be so finely detailed.
So the key being, we need to revisit where we are.
But we're talking about more and more intervention. And you said, you know, we want to do something. And I'd like to get back to maybe saying there's always something we can do. I like to have an NNT, a number needed to treat one. And that is with kindness. And so I know this will seem like, you know, apple pie, but I did grow up on an apple farm. So I think it's
the most Canadian thing of the entire podcast.
Yeah, I grew up on an apple farm. And, you know, you can sit there and sometimes all you need to do, no matter what the tragic event is, and I, this just came up on my feed the other day because Robin Williams passed away 6 years ago. I think it was August 11th, and it came up on my feed, and there was that Patch Adams quote about, you know, you treat a disease, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but you treat a patient with caring and kindness, you'll always win. And so sometimes that just means bearing witness, spending time with them, taking a moment, and then moving on.
And sometimes the best treatment
is no treatment.
Exactly. The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, Dr. Ken Milne, one of the frequent visitors here to the ASAP Frontline podcast, and probably one of the best interpreters and translators of evidence, data, and research that I could ever know. And always an honor to know him, contact him, and get to talk with him on occasion. So, Dr. Milne, I really appreciate it.
You're far too kind, and I look forward to our next Whiskey Bourbon Summit.
Well, we got the next summit coming up next. After, we're going to have to take a break for Unconventional, which I hope everybody checks out. That's going to be a great way to get some great education, CME information from the comfort of your own home.
While wearing sweatpants.
While wearing, or no pants, whichever.
Hey, now.
It may be jeans. Oh, that's what I meant the whole time. Everybody knows the COVID outfit. You know, the Zoom interview that I actually have a picture that I posted on the Stanton MD Facebook page that had me for a TV interview, I think for the Today Show. And I had on a button-up shirt with a tie and a suit jacket and old rotten-out navy blue scrub pants and with flip-flops on. I think this is everything COVID has to do with media right here.
That's just a whole COVID 2020 meme right there.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. So how can folks contact you, get in touch with you, social media, as well as the podcast?
So you can follow me on Twitter. It's at the SGEM. And then, of course, there's the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. And if you want to email me, if you have further questions or follow-ups, or I've piqued your interest in any way, you can email me. It's thesgem@gmail.com.
And the way his podcast breaks down, it's honestly, it breaks down like a journal. His podcasts are very regimented, and the key being to break down each topic the same way every single time, starting from the case presentation through the kind of hypothesis and background, all the way through the breakdown, and of course, talking nerdy, and then the summary and the resolution.
I try to do it with a blend of entertainment and education. So there's 80s theme music that goes with it. And the next one coming up has an epic Tom Petty song for diagnostic accuracy of COVID-19 in the emergency department.
And many of your guests, or many that we have talked to here on the front line, you mentioned Dr. Simon Carley, who was one of the first ones I interviewed at SMEC Dub in Dublin, Ireland. And then Jerry Hoffman, that we've had on at least two or three times here on the podcast. So you're going to see some cross-pollination there. I definitely encourage checking out the SGEM podcast. Most of you, I'm sure, are probably listeners already. You know, we do interviews and discussions and kind of bar talk here on the front line, and kind of walk through things like a conversation you have in the physician's lounge. And Dr. Milne's going to have that conversation breaking down into helping you understand the studies, the research, and the evidence that is out there in medicine. And as always, I always appreciate you checking in with us, and you know, tell your son, even though the camera angle is weird initially, I appreciate him helping you getting everything set up for us to chat today.
My pleasure.
As for me, you can contact me at youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, or at everydaymed on Twitter. I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.